You'll have no trouble hearing me at the back. I'm going to look at some issues. I've got a few issues with some of the approaches, and I'll just highlight how these manifest. I'm just going to look at population viability analysis first, but at a population trend level, not down at the, you know, fecundity survival level at this stage. It's yellow-footed rock wallaby here in the North Flinders Ranges. We've got lots of data on the yellow-footed rock wallaby. It's testimony to what you can do when you have the data, and it's largely due to the commitment of Denner to continue to monitor species in this region as part of bounce back. That's a lot of that's aerial survey data that's been conducted over 10 years, but also there's about 8 marked recapture sites as well to get that fine scale information which you need. Just a quick one, bit of theory. The rate of change of a population is N at 1 year, and how it compare with N the previous year. And if these formula are a bit stretched, but if there's a formula that's well known for macropods that's used, the Ivlev formula, it comes under the name, but it's a relationship between rainfall and population growth. And you can see there's a point where the population goes positive, so they're growing, and there's a lower rainfall where it's negative. Now, this isn't necessarily annual rainfall, and for various reasons, we're finding with this particular species, it's the rainfall over summer that's critical, and I'll get into that now. The other thing is that if you read a lot of literature on modelling climate change using these sorts of models, one of the things to be careful of is density dependence, whether it's by extrinsic factors or intrinsic factors in the population. That regulation is really important, and you need to consider that when doing these models. So I've added a GD on the end. But you can see as the density increases, the response to rainfall of this species and many other species is a lot lower. But the shape of that response can also change. It can be a blunter, a more gradual response as density increases. So we tested a whole range of these models. By the way, we did, like I said, we found that summer rainfall is the most critical, and from the trapping work, you know, it's a lot to do with recruitment and survival over those drier periods. And just so you can see, I really am a scientist. We did these QAs, ICs and AICs and ARCCs and all these tests to see which are the best models. These are zones, Hawker, ABC range, where the aerial surveys are conducted. And they're the different models that came up. So there was density dependence in some areas and not in others. For a lot of reasons, well, a lot to do with whether there was any threat abatement strategy going on in those areas. Where there were generally threat abatement strategies, they were bouncing up to carrying capacity or over it. Some say that's bad. I say it's a good thing. You can have an argument with me about that in the break. And that's a 3D sort of diagram of density and rainfall. Well, for the more expanded model. And that's just a simple rainfall relationship. We didn't go the same way as Barry has with the ensemble modelling. I used the sort of standard CSIRO technique. I've been interested in trying ensemble modelling with climate models. So we used some global circulation models from CSIRO for 2030, 2070. Different emission scenarios, depending on how humans behave in the next 20 years or so. And different climate futures of interest, most likely driest, wettest. I'm not going to go into the detail of this. That's not the emphasis of the talk. But just so you know, we did go through a formal process of assessing which climate models we would use. We very much followed a standard template. And for this, just today's talk, I'm only just going to concentrate on two. Where there's little change in terms of rainfall. I'm not talking about temperature today. I know, but I'm only giving you a snapshot at this stage of some of the work we've done. And in a 2070 model up the far right, this is a much hotter and drier likely scenario. So just for today, I've just circled those two. So this is the current situation. So what I was able to do is build a stochastic simulation model, throw rainfall, the historic rainfall we've got at every single rainfall gauge we've got there, at those curves you just saw, And knowing the initial population sizes and density dependence and all that stuff, we actually come up with a viability model, okay? So the probability of extinction of this animal using the current rainfall regimes is depicted there. And there's a few areas where they look like they're obviously going to become extinct according to this model. There's no surprises in those areas because they're largely unmanaged. There's no fox or goat control there, so there's no surprises. That's why we've got different zones. I haven't shown the zones on this map, but there's different zones of management that are playing a role. There's a big hole there, and that's because that model didn't get a decent enough R-squared, and so I have to be honest with you, you're best to just cut it out. I'm not going to go and throw dodgy models and start making predictions out of them. So that's why there's a huge hole there. We just don't know what's going on there yet. I'd rather be honest than extrapolate. Now, using... I'll just go up again. That's current. The 2030 prediction of one of the lethal change shows very little change in the extinction rate of this species. Now, that'll become clear in a slide to come. And at 2070, there's obviously more change you can see, particularly right in the middle of Flinders Range National Park, where Wilpena Pound is. There's a bit of a drop there. There's no surprise there, because there's a bit of a rain shadow on the eastern side of that park, so there's no great surprise that there was likely to be more deleterious effect, shall we say, from climate change. And just to look at that change in shifting the extinction probability, that this highlights it better. You can see that's where we're likely to get some extinction. There's some or an increase in extinction. There's more down around the southeastern corner of this study area as well. Let's just throw an alternative approach up: environmental envelopes. I think that's been discussed. This is what they're about. Basically, a species lives in an envelope of rainfall, in this case summer rainfall, and winter rainfall is an example that I've given you. And using that information from presence-only data, we can map that back to geographical space from rainfall information. In this case, we've used ground survey data and aerial survey data. There's a whole bunch of bioclim variables. I'm not a fan of bioclim, and you'll see why in a minute. This is the bioclim prediction of the same species, right? So just using environmental envelopes. It says that's its likely current niche, and in 2030, that's the reduction. Interesting enough, 2070 is a little more. It's not less, for all various reasons I don't want to get into. Quite a different outcome from the previous one. Extraordinary different outcomes. Telling me something completely different than the previous model that I just showed you, which was driven by population data from more than 10 years of Denner flying up and down those ranges counting those animals. It says a lot for... it highlights the importance of good long-term data, but it also highlights the problem with some of these models. Why is that? I've said dodgy there. This is for students. So clearly my language shifts a bit for students. I think environmental models are too abstract, and they're better suited to that continental scale like Barry was showing, that broad scale. They don't consider density-dependent issues, and I think they lack a lot of transparency and do not use any underpinning ecological drivers. Bit of a problem. Why trust either? Which model was right? And that's another issue, because neither approach adequately considered how extreme events can disrupt order breeding cycles, although the former approach I gave you was looking at summer and changes in just summer rainfall, so that did a better job of it, at least. Habitat fragmentation, its relationship to movement and gene flow, the interactive effects with other species. Neither of them can consider that. Some of this has already come out in Andy's talk, and we know what those are: competition, predation, parasites. We'll talk about parasites in a minute. Jose, there it is, changes in species assemblages. I think that's really important. That's not considered in these single species models. And pest species. Of course, we need to consider pest species. Behavioural responses, neither of them consider that. Genetic diversity and adaption. Wildlife health and disease is a big one. I'm on that case now, and I think that that's going to exacerbate. It's not only going to be facilitated by climate change, but going to exacerbate the problem. Adaptation, connectivity. I think fire dropped off the back here somehow. The compounding effects of all of them. And I did have fire, altered fire regimes there. Just to focus on a couple of these issues, I did this other... I like doing dodgy models and then spending the rest of my career picking on them. This one's a model I did ages ago of Eucalyptus obliqua. It's not done by bioclim method. It's using multivariate adaptive regression splines, presence-absence data. And that's obliqua now. Its current distribution. This is the stringy bark of the Adelaide Mount Lofty Ranges. And that's the retraction for 2030, according to this model. Now, I haven't got an alternative model to show, except for the fact that I live in the Mount Lofties, and one of the issues that I've noticed that this misses completely is parasites and insect loads particularly. The stringy barks, if any of you have taken a decent walk, on the northerly slopes during the last drought we had, are dying off where there are a lot of borers attacking those trees. Now, I'm not saying it's global across the whole Mount Lofties, but it's quite apparent as you move around that there's borer attacks on the northerly slopes where there's less water and the trees are more stressed and insects capitalise on that. So that's an example that I haven't yet been able to model. It's a really hard thing to bring into this, but it's an example of where these models fail. The situation could be much worse for the obliqua, I'm suggesting, where research is needed. Population trend data, I think we need to focus on more. There's few demographics life history data available, and that is a big issue, and we only have it for some species. Maybe we have to start drawing analogies more with similar species, so we use surrogate species data, and I know Barry's done a little bit of that work. I don't think we should be comfortable with just bioclimatic envelopes on their own. In other words, I'm saying we need to start collecting more information. Wildlife health and disease. And that's both health and tracking the vectors, modelling the vectors of disease. Genetic adaptation, particularly at landscape level, and I've got a quick finishing example of where we're starting on that now. Inbreeding depression, and that includes inbreeding depression, diversity, proportion of shared alleles, the gene flow issue, and understanding how spatial gene patterns respond to landscape and climate change. What's this doing? We are working on, I've been working on this software. I write all my own software. I tend not to use other software. It's a fault of mine, but it enables me to explore new issues that off-the-shelf software doesn't have. And I think I built this in 1999 or something like that originally. It's an individual-based facial explicit model, but what this does is different is we model we model breeding structures and gene flow in this individual-based model. So this is same species in the north of the Flinders Ranges. That's its current... The dots are our current survey positions. That's where we know it is from aerial survey and ground survey. One of the issues with climate change is connectivity. And, you know, there's two zones here we've identified where there's a break in connectivity for this species. And even we put all the threat abatement strategies in the world out there, do we need to facilitate, by translocation or otherwise, gene flow through these areas in the wake of change of climate? So what we've been able to do is spatially explicitly display inbreeding depression. That's inbreeding depression after 100 years in the population, where there's relatively low inbreeding depression in the blue, and areas clearly on the tails of this metapopulation where the inbreeding depression is higher. So the question then is under altered climate and intervention going to make a difference? This is where we've intervened, and in the simulation model, in the two bridges I drew earlier, we've said in the simulation model we'd translocate. What difference does that make? So we're looking at the response of inbreeding depression to that intervention strategy through simulation. This is knowing something about the breeding structure of the species, the social structure of the species. This is not a random mating rights equation or anything. This is actually simulating explicitly male dominance, female dominance, all of those attributes of the population, and something we know about movement. And their movement is quite limited, and that's half the issue that we're faced with here. So the next challenge for us to finish is to start to bring the landscape connectivity and start to look at the genetics associated with managing this population in the wake of climate change. One final thought and problem that I've started to realise is I call it the inside-out effect, and that is we've got all these bioclimate envelopes saying everything's moving south or up hills, but in semi-arid environments where there's permanent water, we're now starting to see increased competition around those permanent water sites. Okay, so it's not just an envelope shift down. We're seeing water playing a role in competition. And that, by that I mean obviously we're getting more pest species attracted to permanent water sites, and any sedentary populations like this species that are on those sites are now under more pressure than they were before. So there's all of these other things to consider. Thank you.